Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, colleges and universities are facing funding threats from the Trump administration, but the federal government is also going after some international students. Many have had their visas revoked, putting their futures up in the air. And the schools are trying to figure out what to do next. The administration is also targeting a program to help veterans who fall behind on mortgage payments. It could leave some vets struggling to find a place to live. A mother who lost her child in an auto accident has become a crusader for change. We'll hear from her. A World War II vet who died in action has finally returned home to Illinois. We'll talk with some student journalists working to uncover health problems in one county and hear why some people are excited about a plan to allow community colleges to offer four-year degrees. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Trump administration has terminated the legal status of many international students, including some here in Illinois. It's left educators unsure who will be targeted next and how to protect them. Lisa Curry and Philip explains.
Lev hasn't been sleeping much. Earlier this month, he got a weird-looking email in the middle of the night.
It looks like a really made-up email from some scamming website or something.
It didn't bear an official seal or logo, and it was all in plain text. But it wasn't a scam. It was a legitimate email from federal authorities notifying him that his student visa had been revoked. It said that Lev was now in the U.S. unlawfully and that he could be detained and deported. And it warned he might not even be sent back to his home country of India. He could be sent anywhere. But it did not say why his visa had been revoked in the first place.
I think I've been transparent with the U.S. government. I'd like the same transparency when I'm getting kicked out.
Lev is an alias we're using to protect the student's identity. He wanted to talk over Signal for the same reason, so the audio quality isn't the best. The Trump administration has started going after students like him. Students with legitimate visas who came here to study and launch careers in the humanities, sciences, and in Lev's case, finance. Students have had their legal immigration status terminated, abruptly and without reason.
All the attorneys I've talked to, they've said how unprecedented this is, and they don't understand how to proceed in this process.
Basically, the government can't do this. And yet, the government is doing this. So Lev's attorneys told him not to stay.
If ICE detains us, they cannot do anything about it.
Allison Kung is on staff at the University of Illinois Chicago's Asian American Resource and Cultural Center. A lot of her students are immigrants or come from immigrant families. She says it's been hard to know what to tell them.
The bar keeps moving as far as who's at risk.
Her students are trying to go to class and work and study every day under constantly evolving threats. First against undocumented immigrants, then against foreign-born students who support Palestinians. And now, apparently, against any international student on a visa.
I've seen a lot more students this semester in my office crying and just trying to, you know, figure out how they're going to deal with things than I have in a while.
Kung says she does the best she can to help, but her understanding of how things are supposed to work aren't matching up with what's actually happening.
The students, to in some ways battle a sense of hopelessness, are looking for ways in which they can help.
Allison starts to get choked up.
Oh, I love my students so much. They're so wonderful.
She thinks of the student at the start of the story who got the scammy-looking email at night.
I'm so sorry that we failed you, that this country has failed you, and that, you know, your opportunities have been cut short.
19 Democratic attorneys general have asked a federal judge to block the mass cancellations of student visas. Lev, for one, decided not to stick around to see what happens with that. The risk of getting picked up by ICE was too much. So with just a few short days to say goodbye to friends and sell furniture, he left.
My friend said, oh, if you're giving up on, you know, staying in the U.S., then I guess the world is actually changing.
Lev is now back in India with his family.
I had a lot of things planned. I had a lot of, like, you know, future trips with friends, all that, you know, personal goals, and, you know, I'll have to pivot all of that. But the thing is, you know, I cannot stop living my life.
He says he plans to apply to PhD programs in Europe. Lisa, Corey, and Philip.
Illinois lawmakers are considering legislation to allow community colleges to offer bachelor's degrees for particular in-demand programs. Peter Medlin talked with rural community college students who say they'd benefit if it passes.
Near the end of his budget address this year, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker asked a community college student in the crowd to stand up.
Melissa wants to pursue a baccalaureate degree in nursing, but the cost and the commute to a school farther away will make it too expensive.
The governor said there are students like Melissa all over Illinois, and the state should help them.
And that's why I'm proposing that we allow community colleges to offer four-year baccalaureate degrees for in-demand career paths. Nursing, advanced manufacturing, early childhood education, and beyond.
Illinois wouldn't be the first state to allow community colleges to offer four-year degrees. 24 states already do, and almost all of them include requirements the school has to meet before they can start. In Illinois, community colleges would have to prove there's an unmet workforce need they can meet, offer evidence that they have the financial resources and staff to provide it, and demonstrate that they're not duplicating a program already offered at a school in their district. For example, community colleges wouldn't offer a psychology or elementary education degree.
Those kind of programs really are the bread and butter of the universities. They do them so well. It's the targeted, really, to a different population who otherwise is not going to get a degree. And we've seen that in Illinois.
That's Tracy Morris. She's the president of Illinois Valley Community College in Oglesby. And she says this would be a seismic shift.
When you are where we are and there's not a college for an hour away, the default reaction is, we'll just do online. But it's not always the best learning.
And for students who work full-time or have kids, commuting that far or moving is just not an option. It's something Michael Jenkins has been thinking about. He's an advanced manufacturing student at Sauk Valley Community College in Dixon. He just graduated with a credential and re-enrolled to take even more classes. He also works full-time as an electronics technician at a company that makes diesel parts.
So we have big, huge, heavy coolers. My job is to maintain production lines, keep machines running, and keep making parts.
He's planning to transfer to NIU for his bachelor's degree so he can transition from the production floor to an engineering position, but because of his work demands, that's not going to be for a few years.
My current plan would require me to either commute over an hour to get to NIU or to actually relocate. But if it's all at Sauk, I really don't have to do anything. I can kind of just stay where I am, do what I'm doing.
He says Sauk already has a close relationship with local manufacturing, so it would make sense to build on that with a four-year program.
The things you're doing in your classes are very much what you're going to end up doing on your job. So it is very focused, very specific.
Jenkins says there are a lot of people in his rural community who want to stay and work these jobs, but just don't have the opportunity. And he says employers know that if you leave to go to school at NIU or another university, it's unlikely you'll come back. Samantha Feather is about to graduate from Sauk Valley's nursing program.
I think that it would be amazing for all of us that are graduating this year and to come, really.
She says most of her classmates are thinking about doing their bachelor's degree online, but this bill would allow them the flexibility to stay in person with the instructors they trust while also working the floor at a local hospital. And one of the big selling points of attending community colleges is the lower tuition costs. And with that in mind, the legislation limits the costs of the four-year programs. The price can't be more than 150% higher than the two-year programs they offer. The Community College Bachelor's Degree bill is currently in the House Rules Committee. It has more than 50 co-sponsors, including half a dozen Republican lawmakers. I'm Peter Medlin.
Research shows college students are going hungry at a higher rate than the U.S. population as a whole. Last year, Jess Savage reported on how some college campuses are working on creative solutions.
At Northern Illinois University, it's watering time at the campus garden. Brian Flower directs NIU's Edible Campus program. He shows off the free-to-pick gardens as the university's clock tower chimes.
So we've got some amazing stuff in here. I always love the beauty of the eggplant flower. The colors on them are beautiful.
Students picked hundreds of pounds of produce directly from the garden last year, but many don't have access to kitchens in the dorms. So Flower created a food prep program for students to learn how to make their own meals.
And I've had students who have said, if I didn't have this that I could pull out of my freezer, I'd be going from breakfast all the way to dinner, not having anything to eat.
NIU's Edible Campus is one solution to a glaring issue on college campuses across the country. Experts agree that more than a quarter of all students have limited or uncertain access to nutritious food. And universities nationwide often underestimate the number of their students who are food insecure. The Hope Center at Temple University in Philadelphia conducts research on student hunger and policy. Researcher Stacy Perniski says when students don't know when their next meal is coming from, it adds to their stress levels.
That students are regularly making decisions about which bills to pay, about whether to go to work or to class, about whether to work three jobs versus two jobs, about how much sleep they can afford based on how many jobs they have to work and when their classes are.
Perniski says the Hope Center also makes recommendations and advocates for systemic change across the U.S. Trellis Strategies, based in Texas, is a marketing research group, but the organization also does community research, including on student food insecurity. Research manager Allison Cornett says students from food insecure households are 43% less likely to graduate from college.
I just keep thinking about those students that don't make it to the end, the finish line, and just trying to figure out how we can better support them and love those students to success.
Cornett struggled to access food herself in college. She says navigating state and federal food assistance programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, can be challenging for busy college students.
They're trying to get all these different things done, and then we ask them to jump through some more hoops and demonstrate their poverty.
At the University of Missouri, Kansas City, officials wanted to make sure students had better access to food support services. So they put a food pantry in the high-traffic student center. The university also hired a SNAP coordinator to help students apply for federal assistance. Carlin Fidler coordinates these efforts at UMKC.
There's a huge stigma that, oh, if you're going to college, like, it's a rite of passage to be poor and only eat ramen. And I really don't believe that needs to be true.
Back at NIU, student garden worker Emily Larravee is inside the greenhouse, where tomato and cucumber plants are snaking their way up to the roof. Larravee says she's seen how students and the rest of the community can quickly fall in love with the garden program.
Like the other day, I went to get tomatoes, and there was a new student moving in with his parents, and his mom was like, I love gardening. And she's like, can we try the tomatoes? And it was like, absolutely, like, they're free to take.
Advocates say they want to see more campuses finding ways for students to access food. And maybe then the old idea of the starving student will no longer be taken lightly. I'm Jess Savage.
81 Illinois teen drivers and passengers died in car crashes in 2023. That's according to the Illinois Department of Transportation. Tragedies like these instantly change the life of families and friends. For one mother, it led her to push for change. Eric Stock reports.
Chastity Dorothy of Tampico in northwestern Illinois lost her 16-year-old son DJ in a car crash last March. DJ was a passenger in a car with three other teens when the teen driver crossed a stop sign and collided with a semi-truck. The driver survived, but DJ and two other teens died soon after. Dorothy says she spent the next months grieving, but one day decided to make a change.
A year ago, Friday, is when the accident happened. Worst time of my life, worst time any parent can ever imagine. Went through a lot, going through the grief and the heartache and trying to get through that. But after months of it, I was like, you know, there has to be something I can do.
What started as a petition on change.org led Dorothy to talk to her local lawmakers about pushing a bill to prevent future tragedies. The bill would restrict drivers under 18 from driving anyone under 20 unless they are siblings or the driver's child. If caught, a driver could face a six-month license suspension. Current law states a driver on a graduated license can have only one passenger under 20. If violated, drivers could face a two-month license suspension. Dorothy says the current penalty of 2 months is too short and rarely enforced.
Well, to me, that's not enough. That's not enough to bring attention, awareness to this. So that's why I'm pushing for 6 months, because then at least at 6 months, maybe they will take it more seriously. And I also believe that it needs to be talked about in the schools a lot more.
Republican State Senator Lee Arellano from Dixon remembers being a teen driver. He says he got in a few minor accidents, like most teens. It's not uncommon. Teens are 3 times more likely to get in a crash than other age groups. Decades later, without an accident, Arellano says he's pushing the bill because it's important to protect young drivers from preventable accidents.
If it's not a family member, if it's just a group of friends, you're not supposed to have a whole bunch of fellow minors in your vehicle. And the reason for that, as I mentioned, is we don't want distracted driving. We don't want groups of young people to egg each other on into behavior that they maybe wouldn't do if they were by themselves or with one other person or with their family.
Arellano says he talked to the Illinois Secretary of State staff about his proposal.
The Secretary of State might be well aware of some of these challenges and know the history of them over the past 10, 20, 30 years. And they might have their own pieces of legislation or amendments that they have to recommend. So that'll be the next step in the process, right? And then from there, you go to some of the other stakeholders.
Arellano says it seems the Secretary of State's office was intentionally neutral on the bill, but there are other supporters in the legislature. Representative Ryan Spain of Peoria pushed the bill due to advocates like Dorothy.
An idea that maybe we can make a difference in the lives of young people, of young drivers who are at such an impressionable age as they begin their experience driving.
Spain says the bill asks for something that the Democratic majority has been hesitant to adopt, tougher penalties. But he says it can at least be a discussion starter.
For many years now in the General Assembly, there's been a resistance to penalty enhancements, and this is a penalty enhancement. But there is also always an interest on both sides of the aisle of stepping forward to prevent future tragedies.
Banning who can ride in a car with a teen driver could be difficult to enforce. How would police know if a passenger is a family member? And how would they know if the driver is too young just to have friends in the car with them? Mother Chastity Dorothy recommends having teen drivers carry a sticker on their car to identify their age. Dorothy says regardless of whether this proposal passes, she's committed to educating the public about teen driver safety.
We need to come up with something better than what we have now. And so that's what I'm fighting for, and I'm not stopping.
With reporting from WGLT State Capitol correspondent Cesar Toscano, I'm Eric Stock.
There's more on the way here on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The remains of a World War II U.S. Army Private First Class, Robert Bryant, were buried with military funeral honors at the Park Hill Cemetery in Bloomington last weekend. Bryant was killed in action in September 1943. His return home was a long time coming. Cindy Alcazar reports.
Robert Bryant was killed in action while searching for wounded Rangers from his unit in Italy in September 1943. Bryant's nephew, James Bryant, says he was in high school when he stopped believing his uncle would come home. But 81 years to the day, the Bryant family received news they call miraculous.
September 23rd, 2024, they called to advise me that he had been positively identified and that his remains were in Omaha.
The military used historical records, archaeological findings, and DNA to help identify Bryant and, according to niece, Deanne Wheat, fulfill a family promise.
My grandmother made us promise to bring Sonny Boy home, is what she called him. You bring my Sonny Boy home.
Wheat says the identification of Bryant's remains provided more than a proper burial for her uncle.
It's closure for one thing. And, you know, it was a promise that everybody made to my grandmother, bring him home. They offered to bury him in Arlington, and we said nope. She made us promise to come home.
Wheat's sister, Margie Dillo, was flooded with memories of her father's funeral. Harold Dean Bryant, Bryant's brother, was buried at Park Hill with military funeral honors in 1966.
When the music started, he's being buried with my dad, and it started getting us, and then because we remember being kids there at his funeral, and then when they did the 21-gun salute and started the bugle, that's where I'm glad Uncle Bob's getting his attention because it's been a long time.
Dillo says they didn't hear many stories about Uncle Bob after her father died. Her grandmother rarely spoke about him, but it was her mother who shared stories of growing up alongside the Bryant brothers.
He was ornery, I know that. Mom always told us that he was handsome, which he was, we get those pictures. But then he liked to get in fights. So he was good for a ranger because of that. But he was supposed to be really a nice man. And he was a hero.
Dozens of members of the Rolling Thunder participated in Bryant's funeral. Rolling Thunder is a national organization with about 90 chapters in the U.S. Their primary purpose is to bring missing soldiers home by escorting repatriated soldiers to their resting destination via dignified transport. The Rolling Thunder's David Skinner says it was Bryant's act of heroism and his place in Ranger history that stood out.
So U.S. Army Rangers are an elite fighting force of the United States Army. You might have heard the phrase, Rangers lead the way. So they're the ones that go in first, clear the way for the rest of the troops that come in. So PSC Bryant was in 4th Battalion, which is the 4th unit that was assigned to the Ranger Division. He was killed fighting in Italy on a four-man squad when he was searching for other Rangers that were already killed in the battle. So he himself gave up his life in order to search for his fellow soldiers.
While Bryant's identification brings closure for his family, Skinner notes the U.S. currently has more than 80,000 POWs unaccounted for.
And that's our mission, is to get every one of them home as quickly as possible. This really, it closes a hole in the family, that missing person sitting at the dining room table that's been gone all these years.
Although Robert Bryant's nephew, Jim Bryant, had given up hope when he was in high school 50 years ago that his uncle would be found, he says he's grateful the U.S. military never gave up hope, and that's the advice that he has for the families of those 80,000 soldiers who have never returned home.
Stay the course. It'll, hopefully they'll be able to do it. I mean, for like us, all that left was Robert, was a jaw and some teeth. That's all that was left after all these years. So stay the course. The government doesn't stop looking for him and trying to identify him.
I'm Cindy Alcazar.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs says it will end a mortgage rescue program designed to help veterans who have fallen behind on their mortgages keep their homes. NPR's Chris Arnold and Quill Lawrence report.
The rescue program is called VASP. It was set up to fix a previous VA error that had stranded about 40,000 veterans and left them on the verge of foreclosure.
VASP stands for the VA Servicing Purchase Program, and it hasn't been fully up and running for very long, so a lot more vets still need this rescue. But now, the Trump administration says it is ending the program, stranding many of those vets all over again. Republicans in Congress say they have a fix in the works, but that could be months away.
I feel let down and deceived.
Samuel McCrary is a Marine Corps vet. He needed help after the pandemic hit, and VA gave him what's called a mortgage forbearance. That let him skip some payments. But then VA made that big mistake. It suddenly cut off a key part of the program. Vets like McCrary were stuck, impossibly behind on their payments.
The new VASP program looked like it was going to save his house, but now that's ending. McCrary has three young kids who we wanted to raise in this house.
Losing my house and having to go rent, it makes me sick to my stomach to think about, and it's embarrassing, even though it's not my fault.
According to industry data, there are now more than 90,000 VA home loans at risk of foreclosure.
And with today's high interest rates, Justin Wiseman of the Mortgage Bankers Association says VASP is the only affordable option.
Taking it away without a replacement, the only real other alternative, unfortunately, would be foreclosure. And that's very much something that the mortgage industry and MBA does not want to see.
Democrats in Congress have written the VA asking it to keep VASP running. California Congressman Mark Tucano is the ranking member on the House Veterans Affairs Committee.
Veterans have answered the call to serve our country. And when they come home and face hard times, it is our duty to serve them. Ending VASP with no warning, no plan, or no replacement is a betrayal.
Wisconsin Congressman Derek Van Orden, a Republican, disagrees. He applauds the end of VASP because it involves the VA itself buying delinquent loans. He thinks that's too risky. Van Orden, who is a veteran himself, spoke at a recent hearing.
It gets rid of a bum loan, and it passes it off to the American taxpayers.
That comment did not sit well with fellow Iraq veteran Kevin Conlon and his wife Jenny.
That's a hell of a thing to say about his brothers and sisters.
That was so hurtful because these are not bum loans. And they're making the veterans and their families out to sound like irresponsible people.
Kevin served two combat tours and just recently got a handle on his PTSD. Jenny says their house is part of what keeps Kevin healthy and stable.
She says they followed the VA's instructions and then got stuck when the VA shut off part of its forbearance program in 2022. Then they followed the VA's instructions again and are applying for the new rescue program, VASP, and VA now says it's shutting that off.
The level of just mistrust I have, I mean, I get they're trying to cut spending and all that, but it's like, how do you justify cutting something that is to help the vets who were basically put in this position because of you?
Congressman Van Orden has introduced a bill to replace VASP with a different program, but it could take months to stand that up, even if the bill passes quickly. And a lot of vets could get foreclosed on in the meantime.
NPR asked the VA if it's concerned about veterans losing their homes after it shuts down VASP with no replacement ready yet. A VA spokesman referred us to Congress.
We asked the Republican House VA committee leadership the same question. That office referred us back to the VA. Quill Lawrence
and Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Solutions to homelessness go beyond affordable housing. We learn how some support services can help people stay housed. Lucia Ching reports from Des Moines.
Nicole and Carl Glendinging adore their fluffy little dog. He's running all around the empty living room of their new apartment, the first apartment they've been able to rent in 5 months. A bedsheet covers the windows as a curtain, and it's a small apartment. But just a few days before, they lived in a tent under a bridge.
It took a lot to get out, a lot of perseverance, I'd have to say, to get out from underneath the bridge. And now the hard part's staying out from underneath the bridge.
The Glendingings were homeless during the brutal cold snap this winter. They found permanent shelter through a housing nonprofit called JAPA. JAPA is a faith-based organization that fills in gaps in homelessness services by helping people find and access resources.
I think if it wasn't for them, who knows where we would be. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd be on a park bench, probably.
There is a critical shortage of affordable housing in Des Moines, and people who are homeless can now be cited for camping downtown and in other public areas. Finding solutions for homelessness isn't just about building affordable housing. It's also about helping people through life transitions.
And we can love them where they are and encourage them where they are. We're much more likely to have success in keeping them in a house situation.
That's Penny Schramm, a JAPA volunteer. Volunteers will come visit Carl and Nicole each week. They'll check in on how they're doing and if they're having trouble staying in housing. It's part of a program known as Aftercare. Schramm says newly housed people face new challenges. They need to manage a budget and keep up on household chores. But she says they're often scared of losing the place they're living in. Some people keep tents in their closets years later.
Those are transitions for them, and they really need people around them that are going to help them to make those transitions safely.
Schramm says most people in homeless situations have had broken lives already. That's why providing housing with no supportive services isn't enough. In fact, Homeward, Polk County's homelessness planning organization, saw this play out during COVID. Angie Author is the CEO of Homeward. She says emergency housing vouchers issued during the pandemic didn't have case management to support people moved into permanent housing. Without case management, many of them weren't successful in staying housed.
So having some of those supports to really just even help someone periodically with some supports would be beneficial. But definitely housing with supportive services will be the answer for our community.
Homeward also conducts a vulnerability assessment of people who are unhoused to determine who needs the most help and what kind of help. 5 years ago, 34% of people who took the assessment needed permanent supportive housing rather than shorter-term rental support. Now, that number's gone up to 58%. Author says that means people are now more vulnerable and need more resources.
We're going to need partnerships from county, from cities, from employers, from nonprofits, from service providers, from private citizens. This is going to take a community response.
The Glendingings are now receiving financial assistance through a federal program. Nicole says having additional help through a program like Joppa's Aftercare means the couple has a stronger support system as they settle into their new apartment.
You were never handed an instruction manual on this is the way life is going to go, or, you know, or this is how you're supposed to raise your kids and this is how you're supposed to be, you know. It's like you just hope for the best.
Now, with a roof over their heads, the Glendingings could finally host their grandchildren for a meal in their new apartment.
Lucia Ching with that report. Thanks for being with us here on Statewide This Week. We're glad to have you along. Thousands of schools, farmers, and food pantries in the Midwest planned on federal dollars over the next year to support local food purchases. Then the U.S. Department of Agriculture cut the programs. And as Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, people across the supply chain are looking for ways to fill in the gaps.
In a middle school kitchen, staff pull trays of baked potatoes out of the oven and dump them into serving pans. Julie Udelhoffen is a food service director for the Clear Lake Community School District in northern Iowa.
Today they're working on a potato bar, so they're getting the potatoes ready, the vegetables, cheese sauce, and we'll also have our salad bar they're getting ready.
Around the corner, staff cut up lettuce and mix in shredded carrots. A lot of the produce being served for lunch today, including the potatoes, came from farms within 200 miles of here. Udelhoffen says it started in 2022 with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Local Food for Schools program.
It just makes my heart so happy to see these kids with a tray full of beautiful food.
In October, the USDA said it was going to extend this program for another 3 years. Udelhoffen anticipated around $40,000 for the school district. She was planning to buy local beef and chicken. And then Donald Trump took office. The USDA, under new leadership, announced in early March it was ending the program.
Honestly, it made me a little sick to my stomach because I'm very passionate about local food for the kids. It's been tough.
Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins was asked about the USDA's decision to cut both the farm-to-school program and a separate farm-to-food bank program during an appearance on Fox News.
As we have always said, if we are making mistakes, we will own those mistakes and we will reconfigure. But right now, from what we are viewing, that program was non-essential, that it was a new program, and that it was an effort by the left to continue spending taxpayer dollars that were not necessary.
The timelines for pre-existing grants to run out varies state by state and by program. The effects have been more immediate in Iowa and Missouri, for instance, than Nebraska and Illinois. Liz Graysnack owns Happy Hollow Farm near Columbia, Missouri. Graysnack says demand from the USDA's local food purchasing programs helped her ramp up production. She hired more staff, bought a walk-in cooler, and new harvesting equipment.
I was providing so much produce through these two programs that it was about a quarter of my annual sales.
She says that's a huge loss for the certified organic farm.
The biggest hit is the fact that, you know, I have families that depend on me for working here, and they've been employees of mine for years, and I'm not going to be able to hire them this year.
Tough decisions are being made at farms and food banks across the Midwest. Tim Williams is with Food Bank for the Heartland, which serves 77 counties in Nebraska and 16 counties in western Iowa. He says the local food purchase assistance program was a win-win. The funding supported local farmers and helped the food bank meet the dietary needs of the people they serve.
By that not coming into the Heartland anymore, it's a big hit on growers and producers, but also people who are in desperate need at a time when groceries and inflation is on the rise that need access to these vital products.
Williams says Food Bank for the Heartland is committed to bringing in local food regardless of what programs are in place. Back at Clear Lake Middle School, students flow through the lunch line, filling their plates with colorful salads, golden potatoes, and fruit. Yes. Julie Udelhoffen says she's planning to contract with a few farms for the next academic year and will continue looking for more ways to buy local food as the budget allows.
I'm not going to let this kill the program for us. Yeah, this is too important.
Like other food service directors, she's planning the menus for the next school year with less certainty. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
We'll be back with more of Statewide in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. GLP-1 medications like Ozempic have been used to treat type 2 diabetes for two decades. More recently, the drug's been an effective weight loss tool for overweight and obese individuals. Weight loss can have secondary cardiovascular benefits, but new research suggests that the medications may have a direct impact on heart health, too. The medications stimulate the pancreas to release insulin, one of two hormones controlling blood sugar. The other is glucagon. That differs from type 1 diabetes, which requires insulin injections. Type 2 diabetes is strongly correlated with obesity. Lauren Warnicki talked with Dr. Christopher Sparrow, a cardiologist specializing in heart failure and transplantation at OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. He says the medications have come a long way. They're stronger and influence other body processes besides just insulin.
Some of the newer drugs, like semaglutide, which is known as Ozempic or Wegovy, as well as tirzepatide, which is known as Mounjaro or Zepbound. These drugs, the newer ones, they have increased potency. They require less frequent administration. They're also associated with quite a bit fewer side effects, and most importantly to most people listening, have an enhanced weight loss benefit.
Am I understanding it that this is really only beneficial to people with type 2 diabetes?
So in general, I would say that that's true.
Okay.
The drug is, here in this country, only approved for type 2 diabetes. However, there have been studies in patients with type 1 diabetes that even though we may not stimulate insulin, that process is not necessarily something that needs to happen for some of the other benefits of these drugs to translate. Now, I'm cautious when I say that because as of right now, it's not recommended to use these drugs in that population in this country.
What are the specific heart benefits? You know, is that correlation or causation? Like, is it, well, your heart health is benefited because you're losing weight, or is there actually a direct connection to heart function?
What I would say is that the beneficial effects are very strongly linked to the weight loss. The more weight you lose, the more benefit you have on your cardiovascular health. The groups that do benefit are patients who do have type 2 diabetes. These patients have been shown to have a reduced risk of heart attack, stroke, and cardiovascular death when they use these medications. The other group that has shown a cardiovascular benefit are patients who have pre-existing cardiovascular disease. Most recently, there have been studies using these medications in a population of overweight or obese patients who also have a certain type of heart failure. In these patient populations, what these drugs have shown is actually improved quality of life measures, improvements in the ability of these patients to walk distance, and they've also been shown to reduce heart failure events. So the excitement behind this is huge because it opens the door not only to these drugs being used as a preventative strategy for heart disease, but also as a potential therapeutic to improve outcomes in these patients who have reduced quality of life due to heart failure.
That means potentially delaying or a future heart transplant or being able to have a better quality of life while you're awaiting a heart transplant?
In general, the patients who have been studied with these drugs are patients who have heart failure with preserved or normal ejection fraction. These tend to be patients who are less likely to require a heart transplant,
okay,
but who are very likely to have significant impairments in, you know, their functional capacity and reduced quality of life. So I don't know if we're at a point where we can say that it has the potential to delay things like heart transplant, and it has not been studied in the population who have a weak heart muscle. And, you know, we're still gaining more data. The FDA has not approved these medications for heart failure yet, but as a heart failure doctor, I'm telling you, I am very much looking forward to the time where we can have access to these therapeutics for a larger population.
There is a potential issue here with availability of the drugs, right? In terms of supply, I think that there has been some commentary that patients who have diabetes that need this drug for diabetes are having difficulty obtaining it because it's in such high demand as a weight loss drug. So is there any way to kind of prioritize availability to those who potentially have the most to gain, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a real challenge that we face, you know, in this current era where everyone wants these medications. It's really hard to say that one patient group, you know, would benefit over another when it comes to the prescription of these. So I think that's a challenge we've had. I think in the last several months, we've really seen improvements in the availability of these drugs in local pharmacies. What we continue to struggle with is insurance coverage. Overall, you know, most insurances will cover these drugs for patients with diabetes, and we're seeing improvements in that patient population who are obese with pre-existing cardiovascular disease. We're seeing that many of those patients are now being able to gain access to this drug with insurance coverage. However, even though studies have shown that this drug is very effective for treating obesity, regardless of whether you have cardiovascular disease or not, we're really struggling to get patients on these medications if they don't have pre-existing cardiovascular disease. And in particular, we're having trouble in this heart failure population, getting drugs for a patient with heart failure because it is yet to have this FDA indication, which of course means that insurance companies are not paying.
That's Dr. Christopher Sparrow, a cardiologist specializing in heart failure and transplantation at OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. Some residents in central Illinois worry their water could become contaminated by an emerging technology intended to reduce harm caused by greenhouse gas emissions. The Muhammad Aquifer is the sole source of drinking water for 1 million people across the region. Eric Stock reports the Illinois Senate voted against allowing carbon capture technology near the aquifer in a unanimous vote.
Carbon capture is a controversial method in which climate-warming gases are taken from the atmosphere and buried deep underground. Proponents consider it a climate solution. Critics say it's unsafe and its benefits overstated. State Senator Chris Balcoma says his top priority is to keep the Muhammad Aquifer safe.
I am for protecting the aquifer, and I think it's a wise thing to ensure that we are not drilling or putting any type of carbon anywhere near to that. So overall, I'm happy with the bill.
The Republican Balcoma originally was undecided a month ago. He was encouraged to see carbon capture's potential to transform CO2 into a sustainable jet fuel, but now says he doesn't want to take the risk. Balcoma says he is taking a data-driven approach, recommending exploring new ways to develop safer carbon capture technology, not near the aquifer.
And I also think that we ought to continue to look at the data out there to see what opportunities exist to find any safe measures or means that we can to continue to drill in other areas that are not around the water.
Lawmakers also heard from environmental groups urging them to protect the aquifer. Vietnam War veteran Mike Kerber spoke at an Illinois People's Action rally in Normal. He's worried about water contamination and likened it to a chemical exposure that caused him to get cancer.
I've had my problems with Agent Orange, and now we want to put CO2 near our drinking water. Can you imagine if our drinking water goes bad, what our grandchildren are going to say? What in the hell were you people thinking?
Not everyone thinks banning carbon capture near the Muhammad Aquifer is necessary. The Illinois Manufacturers Association said in a statement the technology is safe and necessary to help the environment, and the group says Illinois already has the most stringent carbon capture regulations in the country. There is already a moratorium in Illinois on new carbon pipelines for another year.
Eric Stock with that report. The aquifer legislation now awaits House consideration. There are growing concerns in Piatt County about the number of cases of glioblastoma, a rare but deadly brain cancer. Community members say the Illinois Department of Public Health has been slow to investigate the possible cancer cluster in Monticello. That's led advocates to begin collecting data on their own, prompting a new response from state officials. A team of student journalists with CU Citizen Access have been following the public health concerns in Piatt County. Arjun Tucker spoke with Molly Hughes, Stephanie Oriana, and Nizala Salahuddin about their reporting.
Molly, how did your team first hear about this alleged cancer cluster in Piatt County?
Caitlin McLean is really where this story begins. She's a resident of Monticello, and in February of 2024, she was able to address the Monticello City Council, where she explained that after her father-in-law died of this rare brain cancer, glioblastoma, in 2022, she began to investigate in her community. So at the time, she had found around 26 cases of glioblastoma in her community. Currently, her data shows around 30 cases, 14 of which have died in the last 5 years. You know, after she addressed the city council, McLean said that she contacted federal and state officials, the Illinois Health Department, the Illinois EPA, and their responses has just not been timely or appropriate, in her opinion. And we really didn't receive a substantial response until the publishing of our article in March of 2025.
Sure. And can you tell me a little more about glioblastoma and, you know, why McLean wanted to more urgently have those cases investigated?
Yeah, so glioblastoma is considered a rare type of brain cancer. According to the American Brain Tumor Association, glioblastoma is diagnosed in approximately 3 cases per 100,000 people per year. The National Institute of Health reports glioblastoma has only about a 6% survival rate and a survival time after diagnosis of only about 12 to 18 months.
And tell me more about what McLean was, you know, saying as she was kind of conveying her frustration with officials, with the city council.
Yeah. And so really, she was able to explain what it was like to be the family member of a victim of somebody who was diagnosed with this type of cancer. We can hear more about exactly what she said in this clip here.
The EPA has bounced me around from one department to another, and I feel like at this point in time, as a community, we need to protect ourselves.
Caitlin feels as though the government and health officials she brought her valid concerns to didn't give her appropriate answers in a timely manner, in a situation where time is really a crucial element, you know, this potential health threat, something that has a lot of emotion attached to it. So the crux of this issue really is that we know these officials, the Illinois Health Department, the EPA, state and local officials are probably not acting maliciously in their lack of response. You know, perhaps they're busy or understaffed, underfunded. However, that does not excuse, you know, this lack of response up to our article's publication.
So your team with CU Citizen Access put out 3 stories following the situation. Stephanie, how have those state public health officials reacted to your coverage so far?
Yeah, after the story was published, Michael Claffey, he's the communications officer for the Illinois Health Department, he said that because of Caitlin McLean's concerns, they have added Piatt County to a list of areas the Cancer Registry reexamines every year. So we didn't even know this list existed, and when we asked for the list, we were told that it wasn't public because of internal planning purposes. So we will file a Freedom of Information Act request to get it. Right now, we are getting the most communication from the health department than we ever have since we started reaching out to them in November of last year. And we hope to continue communicating and updating each other on this story as new information comes out.
Nazala, you've done some digging, as I understand it, into what research is being done on glioblastoma locally and at the U of I. Tell us more about that.
Sure, Arjun. At the Beckman Institute at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, Professor Catherine Popescu said research is being done to manage the effects of glioblastoma, yet it is difficult as the disease can evade radiation therapy. Researchers are working on damaging the repair process of the glioblastoma cells with small radiation doses. Another research they're working on is treating the tumors so that it stops the cell division of the glioblastoma. This method is available to people, she says, although it doesn't cure cancer, but it makes their lives more enjoyable. Professor Catherine also says that the cancer rates or the glioblastoma cell rates on Monticello are worth investigating, and that she calls it a huge cancer cluster pattern. Yet she says that whenever they try to talk about it or bring the issue, they are told not to be alarmed. But observing the cancer cluster pattern in Monticello, she says that they're very alarmed and that it is unacceptable. Geeta Quatra, who is CEO of the nonprofit organization Glioblastoma Inc., also voiced her concern. She said that glioblastoma is the most malignant form of cancer, yet not enough funding is given on researching this cancer.
Stephanie, how have people in Piatt County reacted to your reporting on this possible cancer cluster?
People from Piatt County have been responding very positively towards our story. Many have had family members who have died from cancer and are thanking us for bringing light to this issue. We hope to be able to go to Monticello to talk to more people there and let them tell us more about their experiences with family members passing away from cancer and their concerns for the area.
That's a team of student journalists with CU Citizen Access, Molly Hughes, Stephanie Oriana, and Nuzala Sulauddin. They spoke with Arjun Tucker. You can read more of their reporting at cu-citizenaccess.org. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us, and join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find our episodes where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.